The KYMN Climate Show is a monthly feature here on 95.1 The One and AM 1080, discussing changes in climate and the science behind it. And now, your hosts, Alan Anderson and Bruce Moreland.
Welcome to the KYMN Climate Show with Bruce Moreland and Alan Anderson, where we discuss climate issues in the news, then dig into the stories behind those stories. Alan called in ill, he's just got the common cold, but that put him under the weather for the recording day, so I'll be doing the entire show. My overview, we're going to tell a couple stories, and then we're going to talk about a little bit about politics of solutions. And it'll be an interesting show, I think. So, what story hit us this week? And the answer is, we saw a lot of stuff about climate change, and as always, you know, California's burning and all that, so it's pretty rough out there. So, in particular, there was a nice recent report on the 15th of September that said that climate change will force a new American migration. Now, we know that we've seen this before. I mean, back in the days of the Dust Bowl, a lot of people went west, the Okies and people like that, that just had to pack up and leave because the farmland was failing. And it was failing that just because of heat and dryness and the Dust Bowl days. You know, you've seen the pictures, you've seen where they had to barricade their doors and tape the windows and everything, trying to keep the dust out. And actually, a small sidebar, I actually saw a dust storm one time approaching Omaha. And, you know, it wasn't the Dust Bowl days dust storm, but it was an interesting event because as the front pushes through, it lifts up the dust and creates quite a cloud. Quite an interesting thing. So, what have we been seeing here? Well, we've been seeing wildfires raging in the West. We'll talk more about that. Hurricanes are battering the East. Yeah. Droughts and floods are wreaking havoc throughout the nation. And life has become increasingly untenable in the hardest hit areas. But if the people there move, where will everyone go? And that's what we're going to talk about. So let's start with the California wildfires. 5-year drought in California left them with lots of dead wood and dry wood. And in this last year, or in the year 2019, fires were burning all through. And we remember thinking, boy, it's the end of the world. Well, this year, 900 fires burned 6 times as much as in 2019 over just 2 weeks. So the two factors that contribute, and this is factors that contribute in a analytical sense. If I were doing statistics, I'd put both of these into the equation to figure out what was the cause. And one of the causes is hotter, drier weather, climate change. Basically, the heat has made it easier for the wood to dry out. The second thing that contributes, of course, is the federal policy to fight fires. And we've had years of Smokey the Bear telling us only you can prevent forest fires, with the backup being that the Forest Service would come in and fight the fires for us. And that has led to California being just a pile of tinder waiting to be lit. And interestingly, what happened in August was they had an unprecedented lightning storm that just brought lightning all over the state. And with all that dry wood and everything, it was really easy to start fires. On a personal note, I had talked with some friends in California. I have a friend who lives in Chico and another one who lives in Oakland. And both of them were kind of trapped by the climate or the weather. They said that it was like an apocalyptic sky. They both described and took, one of them actually took pictures and sent me of this orange sky that, I swear, it was just burnt orange, ochre color, just dark. And one of them told me that people were having to use flashlights during the day to get around because it was so dark. And that's pretty apocalyptic. And it sounded a lot like descriptions of the Dust Bowl. They described having to barricade their doors and windows. And, you know, just like the Dust Bowl days, they were trying to keep all the particulates out. And they'd have been wearing N95 masks, even indoors, even when they're alone, just trying to keep the dust out of their lungs. So, meanwhile, as California was burning, and it has burned, Hurricane Laura pounded the Louisiana coast with 150-mile-an-hour winds. And it was the 12th named storm to form by that point in 2020, which was another record. In fact, we're generating these major tropical storms faster than we've ever done in the past. It's really something. So what's the third thing? The third factor we've been talking about is heat. Again, heat leads to a drier California, but it also leads to very, very unpleasant conditions in places like Phoenix. The current mean annual temperature is expected to exceed 29 degrees centigrade, which is only 8% of the Earth's land surface, mostly concentrated in the Sahara. But now we're going to expect that one-third of the global population is going to be projected to experience that same mean annual temperature of greater than 29 degrees centigrade. And that's going to lead to what? Well, it's going to lead to food insecurity because you can't grow crops in that kind of heat. If not just because the crops don't do well, but also because the people who have to work the crops can't work. It's going to lead to water problems. We've already seen water problems. The desert is expanding. We know that Syria had a serious drought. We know that Egypt, the Arab Spring, was linked very strongly to crop failures in the Ukraine because the Ukraine was providing the wheat that the Egyptians needed for their food supply. And what about flooding? Well, while that makes for pretty headlines, heat and crop failures make for war. And we've, like I said, we've seen that in Syria and we've seen that in Egypt, and we're going to see it elsewhere. It's really problematic that the headlines about climate change always seem to focus on what? They focus on flooding, they focus on sea level rise, how everybody on the coast is going to have to move. But in fact, long before we reach that point, we're going to have mass migrations. I've told you on another show that one time when I was at a peace conference at the Hobgoblin, I think it is, over by Red Wing, they were talking about climate change, and they got kind of excited when the speaker from Citizens Climate Lobby mentioned that nuclear power was going to be part of the solution. And, you know, Red Wing has a nuclear plant right nearby. And it was interesting to watch everybody in the room rush to the microphone, because this was a remote presentation, rush to the microphone to tell the speaker, James Hansen, how wrong he was about nuclear power. And I have to tell you, even in Red Wing, where they have their own nukes, there's a lot of anti-nuke sentiment. But the truth is that the anti-nuke sentiment is not really useful in the context of global warming. It's as if we're willing to give a pass to an industry that kills tens of thousands of people a year with pollutants directly, plus is destroying our carbon balance in a way that we're getting this global warming going on. We're completely willing to give them a pass, but we will jump on a nuclear plant because we're afraid of the word nuclear. It's just all psychology. So, census data shows us how Americans move, and it turns out that they're moving toward heat, like Phoenix, toward the coastlines like Florida and California, because those are beautiful places to be, and toward drought. And part of the reason they can do that is what? Well, they're living in air conditioning. They're not growing food. They're assuming that someone else is growing food for them. So regardless of the evidence of the increasing storms and flooding and other disasters, that's not how people are thinking as they're moving. And that's, what do we call that when people don't have to think about everything when they're doing something? Well, we call it a tragedy of the commons, because we, the taxpayers, subsidize that behavior through several things. We subsidize it through FEMA, for example. We've talked about how we cover hurricanes and floods. And the question you have to ask yourself is how long until we cover wildfires as well, in the same way that we cover hurricanes and floods? And part of the answer is that has already hit the news that in California they're thinking of mandating fire coverage, which is another way of saying the insurance companies know that it's a bad bet, so the government forces the insurance company to make that bad bet, and you know who pays for that. If it's not the taxpayers, it's the rest of the people that are buying insurance. So an insurance company wants to make good bets because their model is you give them a fair amount of money, they invest the money, and then when you need something covered, they're able to pay you out of their investments, and so they're making money on that. But if you force them to insure something that they can't collect enough premium for, then they are in a world of hurt, and that's how we can mess things up for everybody. We've covered a little bit about another indicator variable. Remember the people who are paying right now for climate change are the insurance companies and the banks. And the banks, like the insurance companies, are starting to not believe the lies that our politicians want to tell us. And you can just ask CFAC to guarantee your 30-year mortgage and watch them run. CFACT, by the way, is a local, I think it's Minnesota-based anti-science group that sends lots of emails out, and I get them all the time. So the 30-year mortgage is at risk in some parts of the country. I mean, when you think about it, if you're going to buy a house on a 30-year mortgage, and it's pretty likely that within the 30 years it'll be flooded out or blown down by a hurricane or whatever, the bank's going to say, that doesn't seem like a very good bet to us. So what'll they do? Well, they'll sell us the house and then sell the loan to Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. And we saw how well that worked back in 2008 when we had the big crash. So there was a nice paper in the New York Times, in June, that talked about how rising seas threatened the American institution of the 30-year mortgage. And it's starting to transform the classic home loan, which is a fixture of the American experience and financial system that dates back generations. Well, generations meaning back to the 20s. And so that's 100 years. I guess that would be three generations, according to the reasoning. So what do we have? Well, we have a poll by some researchers at Yale and George Mason Universities found that even Republicans' views are shifting. One in three Republicans now think that climate change should be declared a national emergency. And I can guarantee you, if you talk to young Republicans, that number is higher. It's the millennials, the young that have not been inculcated with decades of denial, who understand both the science behind climate change and the need to do something. Because it's really fun when you talk to these young kids, and I've done it. I went to the Young Americans for Liberty convention one time, and they're all economic theoreticians. It's really funny because when you mention something like tragedy of the commons, their eyes go, oh, yeah, I know that. We've talked about that. We know that from economic theory. And, of course, they're all about free markets, and they know that the tragedy of the commons, like carbon dioxide release, is something that is allowed, that you have to have a government intervention for. And the question that I have always asked Republicans is, do you want the government intervention to be the Green New Deal type approach, or do you want it to be a carbon fee and dividend? Do you want it to be something that rewrites the market forces so that people have a chance to respond, or do you want it to be something that just mandates what they do and takes away that freedom? So it's a tough fight, and of course I get a lot of pushback, because the easiest way to push back on that solution is to deny that the problem exists, and of course that's the failure of the system, is that we deny that the problem exists, and then we don't have to worry about doing anything about it. So, in any case, now I want to move over to a thing I'm calling the November surprise of 2016. In the summer of 2016, I was the newly minted chair of the Conservative Caucus. I'd gotten that position by being a reasonably good speaker on the issues, and also by being a bit of a leader in some sense. So they made me chair of the caucus, I guess because nobody else wanted to do it. You know how that is. If you leave the room, they vote you in, and then you're back. So in any case, my first challenge to them was to ask them what they thought it meant to be able to call yourself a conservative. And the general consensus was it meant that we were cautious in the face of risks, which means that we're not risk seekers, we're kind of risk averse. It also meant that we're usually willing to accept experts and accept that they might know more than we do. And that is consistent with what Jonathan Haidt discovered when he was looking at the difference between so-called liberals and conservatives. And one of the features was we're willing to accept that experts might know more than we do, whereas the liberal tends to think, no, there is no reason to respect that authority. And we're concerned for others, and we want fairness, but the way we present that concern for others is a little bit different than the way a so-called liberal might. So all this is found, and I'll put something on the website to back this up for you, is at the Your Morals research site from Jonathan Haidt. He's a noted social scientist, and he does some really interesting speaking. I met him at that St. Olaf one time a few years ago, and listen to him a lot. He's very fun. And so I'll put some links on from Jonathan Haidt. You'll like what he has to say about the difference between liberals and conservatives. He has a very interesting point he makes one time. He's doing TED Talks. I don't know if you've seen TED Talks, but they're usually a room full of people. And he asked one room, he said, how many of you consider yourself liberals? And about 80% of the hands went up. How many of you would consider yourself moderate, independent, libertarian style? And, you know, a smattering, maybe a dozen hands went up. This is in a room with 2,000 people in it. And then he said, how many of you are conservatives? And he said, maybe three or four hands went up. And this experience is the same experience I've had in my work, which is that there's an awful imbalance in the room. It's monochromatic is what I like to call it. Mostly blue, a little bit of red, kind of like sprinkles on a cake. So his point to that audience, which probably thought they were pretty enlightened, was that you don't have a full spectrum of ideas in here. You are in some sense an echo chamber, and I'll get into that some more in a bit. So what happened in November 2016, the November surprise? Well, we all know what happened. We had an election, and it caught everybody off guard, including the winner. So by the 2017 June conference of Citizens Climate Lobby, we had grown as people concerned about climate change, who also feared that the White House was going to be occupied by a simple denier, joined our organization to help fight climate change. And it was quite the experience, quite exciting. We still have only about 8% conservatives in that group, but that has held fairly constant, we think, over time as we grew. So there's room for conservatives in Citizens Climate Lobby, and I enjoyed being the chair of the caucus while I was there. So I was going to mention one more person out of the White House. We probably have all heard of Ivanka Trump. She's a bright millennial. She tried to bring her dad into the science, but the first thing I tell people when I'm talking from the conservative perspective is you have to pick the right messengers. And she probably picked the second most divisive figure in politics, in my not too humble opinion about this, Al Gore, to carry that message to her dad. And that was just did not work. It just failed completely. So the other thing that happened in 2016 was a bunch of people saw this schism in our country, and there were people in the West Coast in the Midwest that were just hope and change. This is exciting. We're finally going to get something going forward. You know, 2016 changes the game. Meanwhile, there were people on the East Coast, New York in particular, who happened to be friends with these people in the Midwest, and they were full of, it was doom and gloom. I mean, it was where, you know, everybody was upset. Nobody was feeling positive about the future. And what we realize is that polarization, that ability to be echo-chambered into doom and gloom or echo-chambered into hope and change, means that we're talking to our friends and they're all with us, but the country is not, you know, is not. It's kind of a split country. And the duopoly that we call politics right now is a terrible thing. It was never planned for it. You know, nobody ever said, let's only have two political parties. But in an open market system, the two parties have found that by growing polarization, by making us more polarized about our politics, they can keep us from forming any other group. So we have to, it's as if you go to the car lot and all there are Fords and Chevys because they have conspired to keep out the Toyotas and the Dodges. So that's what a duopoly does. It gives them so much power that they can block change. And when you look at the people that they've been putting up, it turns out that for the most part, they're all in the same corner of the political grid. I mean, we like to think that they're different, but the only reason we think they're different is because we've been told they are. So this polarization that we see is actually, in a duopoly, is a bug. It is not a bug. A bug being something that accidentally enters your system that you don't want to have. No, it's not a bug. Polarization is a feature of our duopoly. So we shouldn't be surprised that all of the electoral campaigning that we see is designed almost as much to make us fear and hate the other side as it is to love and appreciate our side. And when you think about it, that means there's something wrong with the system when neither side seems to be able to bring the message around to what is the hope for the future. So, given that, we have a lot of fear and uncertainty and doubt coming into the 2020 election. We've got huge, both sides now are arguing that mail-in campaigning or mail-in voting is going to be a fail, and their reasons are different, but it has made people nervous about mail-in voting. I myself am not going to mail-in vote because I just enjoy the ceremony of going to the polling place. But that's just me. It's just personal. Otherwise, I'd mail-in vote if I wanted to. I have no fear about it. A lot of my friends on both sides do have fear, and I think it's because they've been listening to the polarization campaigns of our parties. So there's a lot of fear and uncertainty and doubt out there. What we call in the military, we call that FUD, F-U-D. Fear, uncertainty, and doubt about what we will do if Trump doesn't leave. That was a David Brooks New York Times article in September of 2020. That's a pretty serious headline. That's, you know, what do you do if Trump just refuses to leave? A series of articles in The Atlantic describing mostly terrorist groups that are getting ready to give us trouble. And The Dark Psychology of Social Networks by Jonathan Haidt, that name that I mentioned earlier, which talks about how social networks, particularly the like button or the thumbs up button, have created a perverse incentive for us to be more polarizing in our dialogues online. It's as if we're just being rewarded for being obnoxious. It's really, really a bad thing. So I mentioned the doom and gloom in the Upper East Side and the hope and change in Lebanon. Those guys didn't just sit in their chairs and moan. They called a friend that they happen to both know, Bill Doherty out of Minneapolis. He's a therapist. Family therapy is his game. And he brought the tools of family therapy into the discussion between those two groups, the doom and gloom and the hope and change. And they conducted a workshop and eventually ended up founding Braver Angels. Now, Braver Angels' original name was Better Angels, and it comes from Lincoln's first inaugural in March of 1861, which he concludes by saying that we will do much better, and I'm paraphrasing, if we listen to the better angels of our nature. So they wanted to be better angels. It turns out that was copyrighted, so they became Braver Angels, which is, I've been told, is much more appropriate because you have to be really brave to do the things that they're doing. I want to remind you what happened in 1861. Within weeks of the inauguration, Fort Sumter was attacked, and the Civil War was off and running. So, what do we have? We have a new initiative by that Braver Angels group called With Malice Toward None. And the With Malice Toward None initiative is designed to help unpolarize before the election by making us more open to each other's ideas. It's designed to help us after the election to keep from retreating into our relative castles and just ginning up anger and hatred toward the other side, because some of us are going to be ecstatic and some of us are going to be nervous. There's going to be gloom and doom in one room and there's going to be hope and change in the other. So this is all in the context of any organization, whether it's your family. You may find that you've got some family that split on this. You may have discovered that your social group, your social or service organization, and I'm thinking of things like the Lions or the Rotaries, may be split on this and nervous about it. Churches may be split. Everybody is going to be nervous. So the With Malice Toward None initiative from Braver Angels is designed to help you and your organization and your family get through this rough period of time. So why is it called With Malice Toward None? Well, Lincoln's second inaugural in 1865, he ended with a paragraph that said, "With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right, let us drive on to finish the work we are in." It was still in the Civil War. It was almost to end. He had plans to be conciliatory. When he talked about widows and orphans, he was talking about widows and orphans of both sides. He was not going to punish the South in a way that we've seen what happens when you do that. I mean, when you punish a country for losing, a lot of times they'll come back later with a vengeance, and I don't need to remind you of what those are. So what happened? Well, within a few weeks, Lincoln was assassinated, and that was the end of that effort because the follow-on administrations weren't quite able to pull it off. So the Braver Angels sees this as a challenge and an opportunity, and the challenge is that we're going to be in a very divisive election. There's a really good chance that on the 4th of November we won't know who won, and so we'll go through a period where we're just all angsty and constant news coverage. I mean, remember 2000 was no fun. This could be worse, and we're going to have to figure out how to handle that. And the opportunity is the With Malice Toward None initiative. And if you wanted to hear more about that, I invite you to contact us. I'd be happy to talk to you more about it. The basic idea is that an individual can go to the With Malice Toward None website, and I'll put that in our posting. You can sign a pledge, which kind of is a nice little summary of how you have to think, how you have to be careful about how you think about the other side. And a lot of it has to do with, we tend to, when we get into our echo chamber groups, you know, our weekend coffees or whatever, we tend to vilify the others. And we create a group called the others that are these, you know, for lack of a better word, I'll use an old phrase from the 2016, which was the deplorables on one side and the pointy-headed intellectuals on the other. I don't know if you remember that phrase, but I remember hearing it when I was really young, because that was how some people described the elitists on the coasts. So, in any case, the With Malice Toward None commitment lets individuals sign a pledge. It also lets service organizations prepare their members before the election in a group meeting. And then after the election, we depolarize the two groups in separate meetings. So we take the hope and change people out of the organization and the doom and gloom, and put them in separate rooms and help them talk through being Rotarians again, or being, you know, Lions again, or whatever that takes. And then we get back together for a joint resolution that lets us move on with our bigger mission, which is making this country a great country. So, having said all that, I appreciate your having listened. I am sorry that Alan couldn't be here, because I'm sure he's probably going to be feeling better soon, but just didn't happen quickly enough. So, next month, on Wednesday, November 4th at 11, we're going to be discussing the politics of climate solutions. And that'll be really interesting, because we probably won't know how the election came out by then. But we will probably know what the Senate and the House look like, and we'll probably talk a little bit about that. And, God willing, and the crick don't rise, we'll be here next month with another edition of The Climate Show. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the KYMN Climate Show, airing the first Wednesday of every month here on 95.1 FM and AM 1080. Your hosts have been Bruce Moreland and Alan Anderson. Copies of today's show are available for podcast at kymnradio.net.